This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The Catholic Church is being rocked by sexual abuse scandals, mostly cases involving the molestation of boys. In the past few weeks, such scandals have made news around the country, including in Boston, Long Island, Maine, Los Angeles, New Hampshire, and Philadelphia. The New York Times reports that over the last two decades, dioceses have settled more than 1,000 cases out of court involving sexual abuse, according to plaintiffs' lawyers. My guest, Father Donald Cousins, is the author of The Changing Face of the Priesthood, which he describes as one priest's reflection on the state of the priesthood. Father Cousins is the former president and rector of St. Mary's Seminary and Graduate School of Theology in Cleveland. For about 6 years, he was vicar in one of the larger U.S. dioceses, and he's counseled other priests. Father Cousins is currently a resident scholar at the Ecumenical Institute at St. John's University in Collegeville, Minnesota. He says that the sexual abuse problem is connected to systemic issues within the church.
So far, we've been looking at this scandal or scandals as human weakness. A few priests, very few bishops who have had difficulty refraining from sexual contact with mostly teenage boys. And if we keep the focus on the abuse of a relatively small number of clergy, we miss, I think, an important factor. What is there about clerical culture? What is there about life in the priesthood that seems to draw priests to have sexual contact with minors? Even though the percentage is relatively small, it is, by a number of standards, maybe twice as high as it should be. And so I'm suggesting we have a systemic problem or a structural problem as well as the personal moral weakness of a number of priests and a few bishops.
Well, what do you think the larger systemic problem might be?
Well, I think it's connected with our clerical culture. We live the last of the medieval lifestyles, and I think we need to take a look at how we educate priests. We also have to, I think, address structural issues such as where priests live, how they live, mandatory celibacy. The lifestyle of the priest today, I think, is a very lonely lifestyle. Most priests live by themselves. It's a difficult life. So I think we need to address the pedophile situation, misconduct with teenage boys. We need to address our policies and how we respond as church, not corporation, to the young people that have been abused. We have to do all of that. We have to do it much better.
You've counseled priests. Can you talk with us a little bit about what your role was as a counselor to priests?
Well, it would be pretty much similar to the role of a counselor who wasn't a clergy person. Priests from time to time would approach me so that they might talk about their spiritual journey or personal struggles that they were having in one vein or another. And I tried to offer them counsel and direction as a brother priest.
Did you, through that work, get any insights into the type of impulses that priests often have to wrestle with?
Rather than talk about the type of impulses they had, I think my experience and the experience of other vicars with which I have consulted, and I think it's good that we talk about it more or less from coast to coast rather than from one specific area. What struck many of us and continues to strike many of us is the relative emotional immaturity and almost sexual immaturity of a fair number of clergy. And some of these men are very mature in other areas of their lives. Marvelous pastors, effective preachers, administrators of large parishes or of important diocesan offices. But in the area of their emotional life, many of them tend to be arrested at almost the level of an adolescent. A number of people have made this connection these days, especially Dr. Eugene Kennedy, that from one perspective, the behavior with teenagers and children might reflect a psychological appropriateness in terms of psychological age. That's not to defend the behavior in any way at all. But I would say that's a common occurrence.
Well, if you feel that the sexuality of many people entering the priesthood is psychologically stunted, what do you think accounts for that?
I think sometimes entering the seminary right after grade school or right after high school deprives the candidate normal, healthy, developmental experiences that foster a mature approach to emotional relationships and personal relationships. I think also sometimes perceiving the Catholic Church's teaching that the experience of human sexuality outside of marriage that is open to children is always a significant, serious moral problem. So our approach to human sexuality is quite interesting. On the one hand, in marriage, human sexuality is a sacrament, an opportunity for husband and wife to encounter God in their most intimate relationships and in their everyday lifestyle. So we have this ideal of human sexuality. I think we're one of the few religions to identify human sexuality as sacramental. And then on the other hand, we make being a sexual person very challenging and very difficult. So there's a certain ecclesial schizophrenia in our understanding of human sexuality. I think that can contribute to the emotional immaturity of a candidate for the priesthood or a priest.
Now, that ecclesiastical schizophrenia, I think, also comes into play, judging from what I read of your book, when some priests decide to leave the church, or to leave the priesthood anyways. You've done some of those exit interviews with priests, and some of them have told you that they kind of felt called both to the sacrament of marriage and to the sacrament of the priesthood.
Correct.
But, of course, they have to choose.
They do. And worldwide, we've lost one-third of our priests, many of them leaving so that they might experience the sacrament of marriage. And if you look at that statistic from the standpoint of active priests, you could make a case that almost half of the active priests have either resigned or taken leaves of absence since about the 1960s. And that's an extraordinary drain.
Can you talk about some of the other reasons priests offered for leaving?
I think a number of priests have stepped away from the priesthood so that they might enter into a marriage. A number of them have stepped away from the priesthood because they've had significant authority problems in dealing with their bishop or other authority figures in their life as a priest. Some people might step away from the priesthood because they feel they'd like to have an active sexual life outside of marriage, either because they're homosexual in orientation or simply because they would like to have some kind of experience in that area. And their own sense of integrity prompts them to say, I can't be a sexually active person and present myself as a celibate priest. So I would say that marriage is a factor, authority is another factor, integrity is still a third.
How do you think celibacy figures into the sexual abuse scandals that we're seeing now?
Well, first of all, a number of commentators have made the point that there is no direct correlation between celibacy and the abuse of young people. Most pedophiles and most people who abuse youngsters tend to be married men, which is not surprising in light of the population at large. However, I think there is a higher incident rate among clergy. Estimates vary from 5% to 10%. It might even be higher in light of the fact that there are many incidents of abuse that do not come to the attention of a local church, a diocesan bishop. So celibacy, I think, can be a factor, because to lead a healthy celibate life, one needs to have, I think, exceptional emotional maturity. And we're finding that priests do not have that level of emotional maturity. And to be honest with you, our bishops have known that from the early 1970s, when studies were done on the psychology of the priest and the sociology of clerical life.
What does it take to live a healthy celibate life?
Well, I think, first of all, the individual has to be a person of faith and who believes that a relationship with God is primary to his or her life as a celibate. In addition to the spiritual dimension of a healthy prayer and faith life, the paradox is that to lead a healthy celibate life, the individual needs to have healthy, celibate, intimate, honest relationships with people who are his peers. One of the factors that vicars, I think, have discovered who work with priests who have gotten into trouble because of abuse of minors is that very often they have friends who are teenagers or friends that are much older than they, but they don't seem to have honest adult friendships with people their own age.
Why not?
I think it's because of their emotional immaturity. They find the kind of self-revelation, the kind of vulnerability that are integral to an adult relationship, they find that very threatening. They don't like who they are sexually. I think they're uncomfortable with their sexual impulses. There is not a culture that encourages them to speak openly with personal friends, of course. About being a sexual person.
What discourages that kind of conversation in the culture?
Well, again, it's our clerical culture. We people who are celibate, we clergy and religious, we're expected, I think, to lead lives that are somewhat angelic. We're just not sexual people. Now, on the one hand, we'll say, of course we are, and in our seminaries and in adult education programs for clergy, there are all kinds of programs on boundary issues and being sexual. But we have a very conflicted culture that fosters secrecy and denial. And where those realities are present, you're not going to live in a healthy environment.
Are you suggesting that you think seminaries should be more open about sexuality, that there should be some kind of discussion of it within the seminary itself?
Well, absolutely. And many seminaries today are trying mightily to have appropriate structures, either classes or formation programs or conferences that various faculty give to the students, dealing with issues relating to human sexuality, to the need for intimacy for a celibate, about boundary issues. But my feeling is even those programs, as good as they are counterbalanced by a climate that works against that kind of healthy, open exchange of human experience.
Can you talk firsthand at all about what it's like in that climate, the difficulty of dealing with your own sexual impulses and sexual confusion and the kind of sexual transcendence that you have to reach in order to remain a celibate priest, the difficulty of dealing with that in the seminary or in the priesthood?
Well, you move into almost a monastic environment when you enter a seminary, whether you're studying to be a diocesan priest or not. In that quasi-monastic environment, you're expected to lead a celibate life from day one. And to acknowledge either to a faculty person or to your spiritual director or your formation director that you're finding celibacy challenging and difficult, in a way it's to put yourself in a vulnerable position. Perhaps my seminary professors will think I'm not capable of leading a celibate life. And then to talk about any kind of sexual activity or sexual attraction, that in itself is perceived as wrong and sinful by a number of people in church formation today. So the seminarian is put in a very awkward position and given a double message. Really don't talk about your sexual impulses or your sexual confusion or your concerns about celibacy, except in very secret controlled environments. And so that breeds an atmosphere of unreality.
Last week, the Pope spokesperson said that homosexuals should not be ordained as priests. He said the ordination of anyone with homosexual inclinations is invalid, whether he practices celibacy or not. Interpret that statement for us. Is this a new position for the Church, or is this a restatement of something that the Church has always said?
Well, actually, there are two statements there. One was stated a year or two ago by Archbishop Bertone, who is the number two man in the Vatican's Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith. Over a year ago, he implied or stated that a candidate for the priesthood, somebody who applies to a seminary who is homosexually oriented, should not be accepted. I don't think that's a prudent policy. I think it's one way of saying, of acknowledging that about 80 to 90% of the misconduct cases with minors involve a priest and young boys. So I think there the Vatican approach might be, let's not admit anyone to the seminary who acknowledges a homosexual orientation. I think that's, first of all, very difficult policy to operate, and I think it's unfair to many fine young candidates and older candidates for the priesthood. The second issue is whether or not a gay man can be validly ordained a priest. From my understanding of theology, I want to say that's ridiculous. I just can't understand that at all. And until that comes from kind of a high-ranking Vatican source, I simply deny that.
The Pope's spokesperson isn't high-ranking enough?
Actually, that's what he is. He's kind of head of the Vatican press corps. No, I think that by a high-ranking Vatican official, I'm referring to someone like Archbishop Bertone, the number two man at the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith, or Cardinal Ratzinger, or that level of church leadership.
Let me bring up what seems to be a problem for the very reflective, perhaps intellectual priest, which is, you know, you're supposed to be spending some of your time reading and thinking and reflecting. And it seems to me the more you're given to reflection, the more you're given to question things. The more you read, the more different points of view you're exposed to, the more your orientation becomes to question things and to think them through and then to arrive at a conclusion, which might often or at least sometimes lead you to challenge the church hierarchy on its conclusions. So reflection might actually be kind of troublesome to a priest.
Well, it might. And to be honest with you, there are priests that have reduced their world to the boundaries of their parish. They don't do serious reading, and they simply want to make it through the day and work as hard as they can, meet the pastoral needs of the parish, and in a sense, turn off their intellect. However, I really hope that's not the majority of our priests today. Priests today do need to read and study. They need an honest cultural life, novels and theater and good film. All of that expands the imagination, and that's critical for our primary ministry of preaching. However, once we do read and once we do reflect on our pastoral experience, I think then we're in a position to enter into a significant dialogue with theologians and with bishops and church leaders. This is the way the church is meant to work. The Catholics in the United States are highly educated, and they are thinking people. And sometimes we priests and bishops don't take them seriously enough. At times we talk down to them as if we do have all of the answers, and they have none of the answers.
It's part of the crisis in the priesthood that you write about, this fact that sometimes reflection can lead to challenging, can lead to questioning the church hierarchy, and that's not encouraged.
As a matter of fact, it is encouraged by the church, especially from the documents of the Second Vatican Council. We do invite priests and laity who have reflected on issues and who have the competence to speak about them to address their bishops and their pastors. But it seems like the church is not that eager always to listen, even though they have invited people to speak up and to speak from their experience. That's the way the church has operated more or less effectively for the last 2,000 years, although we are now in a period of almost suppression of honest dialogue, and that's unfortunate.
I want to get back to the question of homosexuality. One of the ways that the church is reacting to the current sexual abuse scandals is to say that gay men shouldn't be priests. What action do you think the church is going to take that they haven't taken before to try to prevent gay men from becoming priests or to try to weed out gay men who are priests?
Any action, I think, will prove not to be successful. We only know of an individual's orientation by self-disclosure. So I think if we try to implement a directive from the Vatican that says gay men should not be admitted into our seminaries, I think we'll find ourselves faced with a good deal of deception and a lack of candor. That's not a good way to begin your studies for the priesthood, because the priesthood means that you're a bearer of the Word of God, a bearer of the truth. In that kind of a climate, you have a climate of secrecy. I just don't think it can be enforced. And if people try to enforce it, I think we'll have a significant decline in our seminary membership today. And we're already almost dramatically reduced in numbers compared to, say, 1965.
Is there an estimate about what percentage of the priesthood is gay?
Well, there are various estimates, and I reported on these estimates in the Changing Face of the Priesthood. I think it's important to simply note that the percentage is higher in our seminaries and priesthood, the percentage of gay men. How much higher is it than in the general population? That's very difficult to know. Estimates range from 10% to 50%.
Why do you think that there is a larger percentage of gay people represented within the priesthood than there is in the general population?
Well, a number of scholars, Mark Jordan in particular, who teaches at Emory University, and he's the author of The Silence of Sodom, Jordan puts it this way: a young man discovers that he's homosexually oriented. The church tells him that he can never act out his sexuality. By the very fact that he is homosexually oriented, the church says you're called to lead a celibate, chaste life for the rest of your life. Well, if you have to lead a celibate life anyway, if you're a fairly bright person, why not then enter the seminary and become a priest, and at least, in a sense, be rewarded for the celibacy that the church says is necessary for you, whether you're a priest or not. That's one explanation that I think has a certain merit to it.
Others?
Others might be. I don't have to explain to people why I'm not married if I happen to be a gay candidate for the priesthood. I'm going to be able to live in fairly close proximity with other men who share some of my same interests and same orientation. It can be a meaningful, rewarding, and comfortable life for a number of gay priests and seminarians.
From your perspective as a priest, what impact do you think it has on the culture of the church and the culture of the priesthood to have many gay priests?
Well, I think we've had many gay priests for thousands of years. If you think about it, priests can put on robes, wear lace surplices. There's a certain almost homoerotic dimension to church culture and society. I certainly don't want to say that there's anything wrong with wearing cassocks and vestments. But I think we're going to see in the years ahead more awareness of the kind of the sexual ambiguity that is present in the priesthood today.
You mean in terms of the vestments and the theater of surrounding the rituals?
Yeah, the whole lifestyle. You know, there is a certain, let me say, non-masculine dimension to priesthood today. And I think there are many strong masculine men in the priesthood and in our seminaries today. But there is even culturally a certain ambiguity that has to do with vestments in particular in clerical dress.
You think that would be a healthy thing to acknowledge?
I do. In fact, I'm trying to do
that right now, right?
Trying to do that right now and in the writing I'm doing, Terry. Yeah.
Right. And what reaction do you get when you bring this up with other priests?
Good question, because it's either, thank you for trying to raise these issues, we need to address them and talk about them. That's one. And the other is, how could you do that? You know, you're attacking the priesthood, and the priesthood is under attack already. Let's not talk about these issues, even though they might be real issues. Let's try to deal with them very quietly for the good of the church. So it's either, it's about time we address these issues. On the one hand, you're not helping the situation at all. So.
Now, I should say, you express a concern in your book that if the number of gay priests, if the percentage of gay priests becomes too high, it might become really uncomfortable for straight priests. What's your concern?
My concern is that some men considering studying for the priesthood have decided against entering the seminary because they have this intuition. Their read is that there are high percentages of gay men in seminaries and in the priesthood, and they're not sure they will feel comfortable in environments that have a significant number of homosexually oriented men. Is that fair? Is that reasonable? I'm going to leave that to others, but I think that there are indeed straight seminarians or straight candidates for the priesthood that are not even considering applying for admission because of that. At the same time, as I've raised this issue, gay priests have told me, you know, that indeed might be the case, but do you realize how destabilizing it is for a gay priest to be active in a church that has such a strong teaching about the disordered character of being homosexually oriented? So there's a fair amount of unease or destabilization, as I refer to it in The Changing Face of the Priesthood, among both straight and gay seminarians and priests.
Since we're talking about homosexuality and the priesthood, and since the church is saying that it thinks that gay men should not become priests, I want to ask you about Father Michael Judge. He was a fire department chaplain. He was the first official death at the site of the World Trade Center. I mean, he has just become a hero, I think, around the world to a person who was absolutely selfless. He was there to minister to the men of the fire department, and he was killed in the process. And everyone seemed to love him. A lot of people seemed to know he was gay. Whether or not he was officially out or not, I think it wasn't the best-kept secret in the world. I'm wondering what the discussion about that is within the church.
I believe Michael Judge is without doubt a hero, and I think it's important that people come to see a committed, effective gay priest prove to be a hero. And there are Michael Judges throughout the priesthood today. And we can be so unfair to our gay brother priests and to gay seminarians in light of what's going on in Boston and in other parts of the United States today. And Father Michael Judge revealed that priests still play a very significant, important role in the lives of Catholics today. Catholics live and breathe because of their commitment to a sacramental way of life, and priests play such a significant role in the worship lives of Catholics and in their sacramental lives. So there is Michael Judge, a true priest, ministering to people, bringing them the sacrament of the sick in very extraordinary circumstances, and giving his life for his people. I mean, that's what priesthood is about. So he is a hero, but there are so many other heroes, gay priest heroes and straight priest heroes, and I have the utmost respect for these men who are leading very difficult lives today.
I want to get to another crisis that you raise in your book, and that's the graying of the priesthood. I guess the majority of priests are over 40. Give us a sense of what the statistics are age-wise.
Indeed, we are over 40. The average age of priests today is very close to 60. And seminarians today are, for the most part, in their 30s. Probably 60% of our seminarians are over 30. And in many seminaries today, the age range would go from, say, 22 or 3 to 52 or 53. So the graying of the priesthood is clearly a factor that needs to be addressed. And I certainly don't know what to say about that, other than older priests can have a great deal of life experience, and many prove to be wonderful priests and pastors. But the years of service they give to the church will probably be cut in half in terms of the number of years a man who is ordained to the priesthood at age 25, 26 can give to the church.
Well, you say in your book that you think one reason, perhaps, for the graying of the priesthood is that the reasons for entering the priesthood or not entering the priesthood are kind of different now than they were decades ago. For instance, like, it was much more appealing, perhaps, for the sons of European immigrants to enter the priesthood than it is now. Would you talk about that a little?
Yes, I think that a generation ago, and in fact 2 to 3 generations ago, for a young Catholic man, it's higher to imagine a more significant way of life than to be a Catholic priest. So when the Catholic Church was both an immigrant church and primarily an ethnic church, vocations to the priesthood were plentiful. Now Catholics are one of the best educated groups of people in the United States. A factor here in the vocation crisis, if I can use that expression, is the success of our Catholic schools. You'll find Catholics today in leadership positions in all of the major walks of life. So now we've been assimilated into the mainstream of U.S. life, and I think our different cultural position or social position, as well as the success Catholics have had in terms of education and entrance into the professions, gives a young Catholic boy today many more options than what he had 50 years ago.
And you wonder, too, if a lot of mothers are more reluctant now to have their sons become priests.
Absolutely. The research indicates that the role of parents, especially the mother, and priests who do recruiting, you know, a parish priest will say to a young man, or today to an older man, you know, have you ever thought of the priesthood? I think you have the qualities to make a very fine parish priest. Some would argue the priests today are less reluctant to recruit, explicitly recruit, because they're finding their lives so challenging and difficult. And there is evidence that mothers today do not want a son of theirs to be priest, not because they don't have a high regard and respect for the priesthood in general, but because they understand how difficult the life is and how challenging it can be. The other factor is the number of children Catholic families have today. The Catholic family in the United States probably has 1.8 children. I'm told that's the average number of children families have in the United States in general. If you're having two children or less, chances are you're going to have but one son. And many mothers and fathers want grandchildren and great-grandchildren. And I think these are all factors that play into the vocation crisis.
We were talking a little earlier about celibacy in the church. Do you think that there will come a time when priests don't have to be celibate, when that rule will be changed?
Many people today feel that it will be changed. I do need to say that we do have optional celibacy in the church today in the Eastern rites of the church in Europe. So we do have a married clergy today. They represent a small minority of the church. But mandatory celibacy is required for Latin rite priests. I think in the United States also we have probably around 100 married Latin rite Catholic priests. All of these men are converts to the church, mostly from the Episcopal, Lutheran, and some from the Methodist traditions, as I understand it. Will that come to pass? I think it will. I think most people know that we've had a married clergy, even in the Latin rite, for the first 1,000 years of the church's history. Obligatory celibacy or mandatory celibacy for the Latin rite was instituted in the 11th century. So it might come to pass. This is a very, very neuralgic issue for many. They don't want people like myself talking about either misconduct with minors or the sexual orientation issue. They see it simply as a veiled attempt to bring about optional celibacy for Latin rite priests.
What called you to the priesthood? How did you know that you wanted to become a priest?
Terry, I've wanted to be a priest since I can remember. From the first day of the first grade, it was simply a realization that when I grow up, I'd like to be a priest. From the first day of the first grade, I had a crush on one of my classmates all the way through to the 12th grade. But I always felt that Joanne Mahoney notwithstanding, I would be a priest. And so I lived in a wonderful Catholic family. I think my brothers and my sister and the parish in which I grew up made me appreciate the wonderful work that priests do. So there was never a point, say, in high school or in college when I decided to be a priest. It was simply allowing this profound attraction to priesthood to come to be.
Now, the priesthood has changed a lot since you were a boy. Were you as comfortable with the priesthood when you actually became a priest as you thought you'd be when you were a boy looking at the priests of that time?
Something happened as soon as I was ordained. My classmates and I were ordained in 1965 as the Second Vatican Council came to an end. The seminary that prepared us for priesthood was a pre-conciliar seminary. So in a sense, the Catholic world and the world of the priest changed significantly just as I was being ordained. I have the strong conviction that the church today overall is much healthier than it was before the Second Vatican Council. But priesthood today is significantly different. We're called to live in the midst of our sisters and brothers. We're called to preach and to teach and to heal and to counsel, but not from some kind of a pedestal. Priests need to be among their people, and they have to understand that they are, first of all, part of God's people. They're first of all baptized disciples of Jesus Christ, and by the grace of God, called to fulfill this marvelous ministry as a priest and preacher and teacher.
Do you feel that in the light of the sexual scandals, that people look at you differently as a priest, that that suddenly every priest is being questioned in a way that perhaps they weren't before, that there's this sense of doubt and suspicion that is, you know, tainting everybody in the priesthood.
Oh, there's no doubt about it. In talking to other priests, in my own experience, we knew great, great trust. We stood on the shoulders of priests who went before us, who earned trust and confidence from Catholic people. In the last 20 years, that has been sadly diminished. And priests today are generally very self-conscious about, you know, just even incidental contact with young people today after Sunday Mass or after a meeting of the youth group at their parish. Many of us are angry at the way the church has handled cases of abuse that have so significantly transformed the way people perceive the Catholic priest today. There are still many Michael Judges, unseen heroes, who haven't given their life in the same way that Father Judge did, but they're giving their lives for their people. And it's too bad that this added burden weighs so heavy on their shoulders.
In your book, you say that there have been times when you've had to tell a congregation that their priest had been abusing one of the young people within the church. How did you find the words to say that?
I'll never forget those few occasions when I did have to tell a parish congregation, I might speak after the masses on a given weekend, that their pastor has been put on a leave of absence until an allegation can be investigated. I began often by telling them I had something very, very difficult to say about someone who is very important to them. You simply tell them as kindly as you can, withholding personal judgment of the man. And in many of these cases, even in cases of priests who have abused young people, they were not demons. They did wonderful work in many cases. So that was always difficult and painful. And to see the look of sadness and shock in the eyes of the parishioners seated in front of me is a memory I'll always have with me.
Did parishioners ask you, how can I continue to come to church? How can I continue to put my trust in a priest after this?
There's no doubt that for many Catholics, knowledge of the abuse of, say, their pastor or a priest friend has shaken their faith, challenged it, and some people sadly have walked away from the faith of the church, feeling that it would be hypocritical for them to stay in the church as a member. The majority of Catholics, though, I don't believe see it that way.
How do you see it? What would you tell somebody who was thinking of leaving because of that?
I would say if you know your church history, you're going to have reasons to leave that it would take you a whole day to recite. So our history is a history of a wounded church. If you're looking for a reason to leave the church, let me count the ways. And but we sense, in spite of our human condition, something of God's grace. And our belief that God is present in the community and in the sacraments we celebrate. Most Catholics say, you know, this is my church. I'm not going to leave it because of the either sickness or criminality or sinfulness of some of the members of the church, even though some of those members might be church leaders.
Father Cousins, thank you very much for talking with us.
Oh, you're welcome, Terry.
Father Donald Cousins is the author of The Changing Face of the Priesthood. He's currently a resident scholar at St. John's University in Collegeville, Minnesota. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Megan Howell, Patty Leswing, and Jessica Chu. I'm Terry Gross. We'll close with music by Shirley Scott. She died Sunday at the age of 67 of heart disease. She lived in Philadelphia most of her life, in and around the area. Scott became known as an organ player, but since the 80s, she performed mostly on piano. This recording was made at Birdland in 1991.